With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. A new California avocado called Luna UCR is ready for its market debut. A new avocado, developed by the University of California Avocado Breeding Program, is just about to hit the world market. The Luna UCR avocado will complement the widely known Haas avocado. According to UC researchers, the Luna variety grows on a tree of about half the size, all while producing approximately the same yield per tree as the Haas variety. The original Lunas were planted in Camarillo, and advanced trials were conducted in Tulare, Orange, San Diego, and Ventura counties. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Florida citrus research and its benefits to California production. Dr. John Chater, a researcher at UF IFAS, has been working on HLB-tolerant varieties of citrus. He says although citrus production in California differs from Florida, his research has perked the ears of California producers.
I believe so, and I am in contact with growers in California who are interested in trialing some of these more fresh fruit varieties, for example, Sugar Bell or Marathon, which are rather HLB tolerant. And so because HLB has been found in Florida, mostly, I think, entirely in residential areas now, thousands of trees being removed, especially in Southern California. There are growers who are looking to the future to try to get some of these more tolerant varieties in the field. Additionally, there are some varieties that perhaps don't have the same level of HLB tolerance, but have exceptional quality. One selection I would like to bring up is the 914 grapefruit-like hybrid. It's pretty much a bitter, to me, it's like a bitterless grapefruit that has excellent eating quality, and could be a very interesting selection for growers there. But having access to HLB tolerant material, it can be quite important for those Californian growers who are looking to the future and anticipating in the worst case scenario what we're experiencing in Florida.
And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more Ag News.
Citrus thrips have been an increasing issue over the last several years. Cooperative Extension Citrus Farm Advisor Sandeepa Gotam said this year was particularly difficult, with growers being inundated with thrip populations.
We saw a high level of damage in 2021-22. What I have been hearing is that thrips have been increasingly harder to control. And there are several reasons, weather being one of the contributing factors, especially in 2023, because of the lower spring temperatures. We anticipate that the overwintering eggs, which would have otherwise hatched early, didn't, because there were not enough heat units accumulated for thrips to hatch. So everything came together at the petal fall time around May, when we had that. I think the temperature in the first week of May was in the 90s and it never went down. So after that, we have had continuous hatching. And because there was already fruit on the tree, there were already thrips hatching and they continued hatching, the damage was already done very early in the season. And a lot of the PCAs reported that many materials that they would have gotten more days out of, usually 2 weeks out of, only give them about 5 days efficacy. Again, you know, it's all a numbers game. When there is too many of them, getting 80% efficacy is not enough. And I think that's what happened this year with the thrips population.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois this week, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack talked about several efforts underway at USDA to help farmers and ranchers be more profitable and sustainable in their process. One effort is underway to open up more local food markets to farmers and ranchers.
We've established what are called food business centers to allow farmers the opportunity to go in and say, I'm interested in establishing a local and regional food system in my area. I'm interested in selling locally. How do I do it? How can I get resources to help me do it? How can I get a value-added producer grant to allow me to convert whatever it is I'm growing or raising into something more valuable that could be sold directly? We've got 12 of these business centers in the Midwest. Michigan State University is the center that's going to operate this area of the Midwest.
He also talked about the efforts to produce more fertilizer domestically.
We've got a fertilizer initiative where we're investing resources in new fertilizer development in this country, so we are no longer going to be as responsible and as connected to Russian and Belarus fertilizer. We know also as well that we're learning more about how to more effectively and efficiently use fertilizer.
And he discussed sustainable aviation fuel, pointing out that electric cars can pull over and charge up if the battery's running low, but that's not the case for airplanes.
But if you're in an airplane and the battery wears out and you're over a lake or an ocean, what do you do? The reality is we're not going to have electric planes. We're not going to have electric airplanes flying across the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean. We're going to have low-carbon fueled airplanes. This is a 36-billion-gallon industry, and we're working hard to make sure that as massive tax credits are available to the producers of this new fuel, that those tax credits are available to soy diesel, to corn-based ethanol, to a wide range of feedstocks.
Vilsack says all of the efforts aren't just for agricultural producers.
It's important to small communities. And the reality is simply this. If you have fewer farmers, you got fewer farm families. If you have fewer farm families, you got fewer kids in schools. You got fewer kids in schools, what happens? The schools consolidate. You got consolidated schools, you got fewer customers for those small town businesses, and they board up. You have fewer customers in those small town businesses, you got fewer people going to the hospital, you can't support the hospital, you got a clinic, not a hospital. And you've got a situation and circumstance where moms and dads and grandparents are sitting around that coffee table and basically listening to their sons and daughters and grandkids explaining why they're moving to Chicago, or why they're moving to Des Moines, or why they're moving to the Twin Cities.
Vilsack on Wednesday announced that the USDA is awarding $266 million in loans and grants to agricultural producers and rural small businesses to make investments in renewable energy and energy-efficient improvements. In other news today, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says there's notably a very short to short topsoil condition ratings for the period ending August 27th.
Some of the pockets of dryness that we're really keeping an eye on, South Central and the Gulf Coast region of the United States has been extraordinarily hot and dry. Texas leads the nation this week, 93%, very short to short, closely followed by Louisiana at 88%. Matching that is Washington State in the Northwest, coming in at 88%, very short to short. Not too far down further is Montana at 82%, very short to short, as we try to finish out the crop season in the Western Corn Belt. Quite a few dry states there. We've got numbers at or above 60%, very short to short in Iowa and Minnesota. And then also, as we have the hurricane moving into the southeast, it is probably a bit fortunate that there are some dry conditions that have developed in parts of the southeast. We actually see numbers greater than 50%, very short to short on August 27th in states like Georgia and South Carolina. So that should help soils absorb some of the moisture that is coming with Hurricane Idalia later this week.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the latest USDA pasture rangeland conditions report reflects usual late summer dryness in parts of the country and raises concerns about conditions in some areas. Rod Bain has the story.
No surprise this time of year that total pasture and rangeland conditions nationwide gradually deteriorate. The latest for the period ending August 27th according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Nationally, 36% good to excellent, down a point from last week. 37% very poor to poor. That is up 2 percentage points from the previous week.
Rippey says while places like an area of the Intermountain West and east of the Mississippi River report favorable pasture and rangeland conditions, dryness in Texas, parts of the Pacific Northwest, Central Great Plains, and Mississippi Valley raises concern going forward.
We're getting late enough in the year that there is concern that when the pastures are in very poor condition this time of year, if they don't start to recover in autumn, a lot of times we're stuck with those poor pasture conditions on into the following spring. That's something we'll be watching in these drier areas.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. The U.S. Cattlemen's Association is applauding recent action by the Department of Agriculture to update the 2023 Livestock Indemnity Program, or LIP, payment rate. USDA recently announced the payment rate for beef calves over 800 pounds will increase from $1,244 per head to $1,618. That's an increase of $374. The payment will apply retroactively to all qualifying losses since January 1 of this year. No action is necessary for retroactive payments, and producers will receive an additional payment if applicable. Payments will be queued up for current losses as early as next week. FSA acknowledged that some animals might have lost weight due to extreme weather conditions, and they're working on how to handle those cases. USCA President Justin Tupper said a loss in today's market has a significantly higher impact on a producer's bottom line, and the updated indemnity better reflects the value of that animal. He noted that while giving thanks to FSA for this update. And the Federation of State Beef Councils has supported an effective and coordinated state and national checkoff partnership since 1963. And the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, of course, a contractor to the Beef Checkoff, and state beef councils continue setting a positive course for beef. Recent program successes include the Nutrition Research, which serves as the foundation for all Beef Checkoff-funded initiatives. Nutrition Research proves beef has a role in a healthy and sustainable diet. The National Beef Quality Audit is the foundational research providing an understanding of what quality means to the various industry sectors. The 2022 NBQA results show that the industry is more efficiently producing a high-quality product that consumers want. And one of the industry's top focus areas across the supply chain remains food safety. Learn more about this on their website, ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A longtime U.S. Forest Service pathologist uses decades of observation of local forests to determine threats of disease, invasive pests, and wildfire. Rod Bain has a story coming up on This Land of Ours.
A 55-year career for U.S. Forest Service pathologist Martin McKenzie has earned him several titles, such as Professional Observer and
Stump Buster,
for his ability to break stumps to find plant disease and fungus that lessen tree mortality, and to identify dead and dying trees in a five-forest region in California.
When these trees die and fall on the ground, they become 1,000-hour fuels, and they'll burn for 1,000 hours when they catch fire. But once you've got dense vegetation in taller trees and low vegetation underneath, it can crown fire, and that's what's the most dangerous. That's what we lose the greatest number of trees.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Retirement plan distributions before age 59 and a half are normally subject to a 10% penalty, but there are exceptions. Withdrawing funds from a retirement account before age 59 and a half should be done only as a last resort, but there are exceptions to the 10% penalty that would normally apply. One category of exceptions applies to both company retirement plans and IRAs. This category includes distributions to your beneficiaries after your death or disability, as well as unreimbursed medical expenses above 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. In addition, exceptions exist for distributions on account of domestic abuse, natural disaster, or terminal illness. Another category of exceptions applies only to IRAs and includes distributions for higher education expenses for you and your dependents, up to $10,000 for a home for a first-time homebuyer, and to pay for health insurance if you're unemployed. If just a company retirement plan is involved, penalty-free distributions are okay if you leave your employer during or after the calendar year in which you turn 55. Early withdrawals made for a spouse as part of a divorce are also not penalized. You still have to report the income from distributions received, but you might be able to avoid that 10% penalty. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Sustainability Project shows successful data. Crave Brothers Farms in Wisconsin underwent a 3-year sustainability project. The results, taken in partnership with Farmers for Sustainable Food, showed some success when using environmentally friendly farming practices. The study took place over 3 years and measured 10% of the land farmed. It included soil erosion, soil carbon, productivity, water quality, greenhouse gas emissions, energy used, and biodiversity. Through the various conservation practices adopted by Crave Brothers, their on-farm sustainability scores improved year over year. For example, the excessive loss of nitrogen to groundwater was mitigated on 62% of their project acres. There was a 2.1 ton per acre per year of soil erosion for corn silages, and that's compared to the national average. And there was 12% less of CO2 emissions per ton of greenhouse gas emissions produced for corn silage compared to the national average. That equates to roughly 5.5 gallons of gasoline consumed for each ton of corn silage grown. If you'd like to find out more on this study and the Sustainable Collaborative, you can visit farmersforsustainablefood.com.
This weekend, lots of grills will be going, and unfortunately, lots of people will be getting sick because of any number of grilling goofs. Agriculture Department food safety expert Meredith Carruthers is with us to give us two of the biggest goofs outdoor grillers make. Top of the list of goofs:
not fully cooking the foods on the grill.
That happens a lot because of one thing.
Grilling really makes it look done a lot of times way before it actually is fully done.
And so she says we're asking for trouble if we don't use a food thermometer to get meat and poultry up to a high enough temperature in the center to kill any bacteria in there. Next biggest goof?
Using the same utensil that you use to put all the raw stuff on the grill to take the cooked stuff off.
Or using the same platter on which you took the raw meat and poultry out to the grill to bring the cooked stuff back to be eaten, putting any bacteria from the raw food right back onto the cooked food, right?
Yep.
And next time, we'll tackle a couple of more grilling goofs. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
In Farm and Ranch headlines from AgNet West, an important deadline is coming up for a USDA program. More after this. The deadline is just days away to submit a proposal for the Joint Chiefs Landscape Restoration Partnership. USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Forest Service are looking for proposals by September 4th. The proposals are for fiscal year 2024 and would seek to improve forest health on public and private lands. Fiscal year 2024 projects will build on the fiscal year 2022 and 2023 investments in projects that will mitigate wildfire risk, protect water quality, improve wildlife habitat, restore forest ecosystems, and ultimately contribute to USDA's efforts to combat climate change. Joint Chiefs project proposals are developed at the local level through a collaborative process. Proposals may address one, two, or all three program objectives, which are reducing the risk of wildfire, protecting water quality and supply, and improving wildlife habitat for at-risk species. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
End of the month and first notice day selling yesterday should be replaced by short covering and a higher close today. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week and begin September. Brought to you by Helena. Extended price breaks in the grain trade occurred at the end of February, the end of April, June, July, and now August. In every case, the market rebounded the first days the following month. So we'll go with history, expecting the same in corn, soybeans, and wheat, especially with the holiday on Monday. Look for a higher close today and into next week. Bottom line, grain analysts spoke extensively with agronomists in the Western Corn Belt yesterday. They report an increase in premature ear drop. They say that can reduce yields by 5 to 10% with lower kernel depth. We saw harvest activity picking up Western Illinois, Eastern Missouri, and our way home from Farm Progress Show. Combines could be rolling in big numbers after Labor Day. This is the bottom line report. Helena says improve your fertilizer efficiency and increase yield potential for next season right now. Great products like Resurge. Visit HelenaAgra.com to learn more. Iowa Minnesota hog weights the lowest this year, a full 3 pounds below the 5-year average for late August. And futures are responding. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
This fall, as farmers finish up harvesting their main cash crops, such as corn and soybeans, some of those farmers will be bringing out right away the planters again to put in cover crops on that land rather than leaving the land exposed to erosion from wind and rain. It does cost money to plant cover crops, but many farmers say it's worth it, especially if they can get some cash payments or crop insurance discounts from the government to help with the costs. Coming up on Agriculture USA, the factors behind the growing adoption of cover crops by our farmers. I'm Gary Crawford. From almost no farmers using cover crops 40 years ago, today surveys show about 40% of farmers use cover crops on at least part of their land. Conservation experts at the USDA have been encouraging producers to try cover crops for years, mostly selling the idea that cover crops help the soil. Ryan Heiniger, who runs the Conservation Technology Information Center, says in survey after survey, farmers who have gone with cover crops say the main reason overall is
soil health, and improving that on their operations is the clear winner, and the very related, keeping that soil on the farm, reducing soil erosion, all among kind of that top 4 or 5 benefits. Better weed control, perhaps even relating to potential cost savings in their herbicide programs as well.
And along with improved soil, farmers who stick with cover crops for the long haul, 10 years or more, those farmers report a significant side benefit, improved crop yields.
It was about a 6.3% yield gain on soybeans and a very similar number on corn for those with 10 years or more experience. So they've really become comfortable with using cover crops, know how to optimize their management.
Dr. Rob Myers with the USDA Sustainable Ag Research and Extension Group at the University of Missouri.
On the flip side, the farmers that were pretty new to cover crops with 2 years or less of cover crop experience still had modest yield gains with soybeans, similar to what we've seen in past surveys, about just over 3%, and the corn yields were not statistically different.
Myers says one problem for new producers wanting to try cover crops is, of course, the cost.
Most farmers, let's face it, are going to have a slight reduction in their net profit because of the cost of that cover crop seed. After about 3 years, we've seen that you start to break even and even gain some net profit as yields gradually increase and the soil improves.
Now, many farmers who currently incorporate cover crops got started on it because of incentives, either cash payments from USDA or crop insurance discounts. The question is,
once that incentive payment goes away, does the farmer stick with cover crops?
Survey says answer is yes. Dr. Meyer says, according to the latest nationwide survey of farmers,
67% said definitely yes, they're going to stick with cover crops after those payments end. Another almost 23% probably yes. So we're looking at about 90% are saying they're either definitely or probably going to stick with cover crops.
And on the flip side of that,
we only had about 3% that said they would stop using cover crops after the incentive ends.
And so Dr. Meyer says
that finding that 90% are either definitely or probably going to continue cover crops after the incentive payment ends really explodes the myth that farmers only do cover crops when they're paid to do them. And once the payment goes away, that's the end of it.
But that does not mean incentives have no place. Surveys show farmers who haven't taken the cover crop plunge are still very interested in cover crop incentives.
And so as a motivational tool to get farmers into cover cropping, I think incentives do play a really important role, and they help cover that transition period of the first 2 or 3 years.
Because there's no getting around it, during the first 2 to 3 years of planting cover crops, farm profits are likely to drop a little bit. So if experienced cover crop producers say they'd continue using them after incentives were gone, does that mean that in the new farm bill we could see a cutback in cover crop incentives to farmers? Not likely, according to American Seed Trade Association CEO Andy Levine.
Well, I think there's a strong interest in incentives, whether it's a cash payment, whether it's a reduction in crop insurance or others. I think everyone's looking at what best fits in farm policy.
But the experts say the role of incentives may not be so much to help farmers continue to use cover crops, but rather to get them to start using them in the first place. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have another episode of the Farm Side Chat, where Farm Bureau President Zippy Duval talks with Louisiana crawfish farmer Joey Olivier all about going from pond to plate.
Welcome to the show, Joey.
Thank you, Mr. Zippy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, I spent some time with you. I think it was in April this spring, and just had a great time out there on your farm. Catching some crawfish. I actually saw a video the other day. They videoed of us picking up the traps. So I hope that in 15, 20 minutes, we can make the people across America know a little bit more about crawfish farming and what it's like. So tell us a little bit about the crawfish himself. It looks like a little lobster. Is it Ken?
Oh, absolutely. It's a crustacean just like a lobster. Across the nation, many people are familiar with crawfish, but they view it as a bait in many streams. There's many species of crawfish across the United States. But in Louisiana, we have one in particular. Common name is the red swamp crawfish. It's the Procambus clarki is the genus species, and it's one of the largest species of crawfish in the United States. It occurs naturally in the swamplands of South Louisiana. And we as farmers have learned to manipulate the environment that it occurs in the swamps. And we have manipulated that into our rice fields and are producing most of the crawfish now in culture.
Okay, so when you say that, give somebody an image of what that might look like. What's a rice field look like? And what does the rice do for the crawfish?
Sure. So we double crop rice and crawfish on the same acres. Now, we've been growing rice for many years in this area, and rice production requires levees, a water source, whether it be surface or well water, and prolonged periods of holding water on rice. Well, so does crawfish production. So we double crop rice and crawfish on the same acres in the same year. First thing we do in the beginning of the year is rice production. We plant rice in March and April and bring that to harvest. And when we finish harvesting the rice, the forage is left over. The shaft provides a good nutrient source for crawfish. And we reflood those fields after rice harvest for crawfish production. And the crawfish actually are in the ground. They're in burrs. Instead of hibernation during the winter, they estivate. There's estivation in the summertime when an animal goes into a period of low metabolism. So when we introduce the water in October, the crawfish come out of the ground, they release their young, and that's going to be our crop for the next year. And it takes about 4 months for those young crawfish to grow to a harvestable size, which starts in January and February of the following year.
So I was amazed when you was telling me how that female crawfish comes up out of the burr and had the little ones up underneath her. And but I don't remember how many there were. There was a lot of them, if I remember.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. A nice, mature female crawfish can have up to 400 to 500 young. It's a process of extruding her eggs and the sperm, which had been collected previously from the male. She mixes it in a gelatinous egg form and holds on to those eggs for 2 to 3 weeks, and then they hatch under the tail, and they stay with her for a few more days, and then they are off on their own. So that's the process.
So, Joey, you said it takes that crawfish about 4 months to mature before you can harvest it. So do you have to supplement its food source and be in the shaft at any time during that? And does the weather affect anything?
Right. So we don't supplement anything. We do fertilize the plant material. And the one we like to use the most is either a rice plant or the forage behind the rice harvest. But we can also use sorghum Sudan grass, native grasses, aquatic weeds that are native. All of that provides a nutrient source for crawfish. And you can, it's very similar to cattle, which everybody's familiar with. The more nutrient source you have and the better quality environment, which in crawfish would involve quality water, the faster they grow. So yes, environment definitely affects the growth because crawfish are cold-blooded animals. So the warmer it is, the higher the metabolism is on crawfish, so weather, temperature in particular, plays a big, big part on how fast crawfish will grow.
So when I was there, you put me in a boat, and we went out onto the rice field that was flooded. I think, if I remember, it was about 2 foot, 18 inches, something like that, deep in water. And we were picking up cages, traps.
That's right. So,
and you had those traps baited with some type of meal, if I remember.
An attractant. So, yes, we like to keep the column of water anywhere from 12 to 18 inches deep. And we have to trap them in cages, similar to, if the audience understands, a cage for a lobster. It has flues or funnels where the animal can get in but not get out. And we put a bait or an attractant, such as it can be fish or it can be a artificial bait, which is made out of fish meal and crushed up grain, anything that attracts them by smell. And we generally have about 10 to 12 traps per acre. And our farm, myself and my two sons, we run about 1,000 acres. So that's 12,000 traps we pick up 6 days a week, every day, 6 days a week.
Wow. So tell us, how many times will you go to that trap on that acre of water?
So we're gonna go to the trap six times in a week, once a day. We take off Sundays, and we'll do that for 4 to 5 months. So 120 days, we'll pick that trap up 150 times in a year, and it'll have anywhere, it'll range from, we talk pounds instead of numbers because there's so many of them. We'll range from a half pound to a pound and a half per trap every time we pick it up.
Wow. So those people that are concerned about sustainability, tell me, what do you do about sustainability? What makes you know that your farm of crawfish and is going to sustain itself for the future as far as population, right, nutrients?
Right. So population is kind of hard to control because you can't see your brood stock because they're in the ground and it's hard to get count of them. So population is one issue as a farm that's a little difficult to control more than all their other environmental conditions. But as far as sustainability, we are producing an ecosystem that is just fantastic for the environment. We're producing a column of water, a shallow column of water that attracts many, many waterfowl and wading birds and snails and larvae of insects. So it's almost an organic environment, other than the fertilizer that we may use to fertilize the plant material that we're using at that time. But very, very beneficial to the environment. All of our environmental friends like the environment and the ecosystem that's produced by crawfish ponds.
I want to go from raising that crawfish to what happens to it next. I know when we took it out of the boat, we put it in kind of like a croaker sack. I guess it was like a feed sack, but it was something similar to that.
Like an onion sack, we call it.
That's
how we package them out of the field. We put the crawfish over a tree to separate any bait and weeds and debris from the crawfish. Then we put the crawfish in, I'll call it an onion sack. Most people understand what a plastic 30-pound sack is. And we put about 33 to 35 pounds in a sack. And they could be ready for market there. We have different markets. The two main markets we have for crawfish is selling them live, which is our the market that brings the most money to us. And the smaller crawfish actually go to a processing plant where we have them peeled, and we sell tail meat, just the tail meat by the pound. And that's a big market as well. It's just to the farmer. He doesn't get paid as much as the premium large-sized crawfish that's sold for a lot.
This was just a portion of their conversation. To listen to the full episode, visit fb.org. Stay tuned while more Ag News after the break.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A full-day workshop is coming up, highlighting research advances on sap-sucking insects and ant management. The workshop will take place at the Lincove Research and Extension Center on September 19th. Mark Hoddle from UC Riverside will be providing an overview of the ACP Biological Control Program and the need to control ants, as well as a presentation on the use of biodegradable hydrogel beads and bait stations for controlling pest ants in citrus. Other topics include infrared sensors and the Internet of Things to automate ant counts in orchards, flowering cover crops to promote natural enemy ecosystem services, and cultural control of ants in orchards. Kern County Farm Advisor David Havlin will also be presenting ant management research and applications in the San Joaquin Valley. More information about the workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Over 130 new appointees will soon provide their input on agricultural trade issues through two USDA's U.S. Trade Representative Advisory Committees. USDA's Rod Bain has the report.
The latest appointments for federal agricultural trade advisory committees were recently announced.
One is called the Agriculture Policy Advisory Committee, and the other is the Agriculture Technical Advisory Committee. So these go by the acronyms of APAC and ATAC.
U.S. Trade Representative Chief Ag Negotiator Doug McCaleb says 134 new private sector representatives will join current committee members to advise USTR and USDA on ag trade matters.
They are able to offer their technical advice and information. They can provide specific commodity production input. And all of this is very valuable to having a successful agriculture trade strategy and to make sure that we are incorporating all the best information into our trade discussions with partners around the globe.
The ambassador notes the importance of advisory committee members in bringing farmer and producer knowledge and input into trade discussions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.